Since 1898, Marquis Who's Who has offered our distinguished listees the opportunity to set themselves apart through our print publications. Now, Marquis Radio offers these illustrious professionals the chance to shine in our one-on-one interviews. My guest today is Dr. Eula DeWitt, who is an enrolled agent and accountant with the Internal Revenue Service. How are you doing today, Eula?
By the grace of God, I'm in New York, and I feel privileged to be here and a part of the American vision that we all have the right to have life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness.
Very glad to hear that. So why don't you start by telling us how you became involved in your profession as an accountant?
Well, from a very young lady, I was always sort of trying to earn a little bit of a living. Mm-hmm. And I began by helping elderly people, emptying their trash and going and get their milk because they couldn't walk up and down the flights of stairs in the buildings which they occupied an apartment in Park Slope, Brooklyn. And they would give me 10 cent or 15 cent, and I felt good about that. So as I got older, it may have increased in different little ways that I always wanted to work. So working and helping, and it just helped me to grow. And then eventually I had a vision of wanting to do things to earn a living, you know, just constantly a vision to earn a living. And then as I got older, I'm going to skip over a lot of my childhood experiences, but I was always, like I said, trying to help. And I was one time working as a receptionist at the YMCA and trying to be, again, helping everybody that came to the doors of the YMCA, Parsons Boulevard in Queens, New York. And an executive who was a member of the athletic club came to my office and said, "Are you Eula?" I said, "Yes." He said, "I heard a lot of wonderful things about you." He said, "Are you interested in furthering your education?" And I said, "Yes." And he said, "Well, come with me." And he took me over to the City University of New York, York College, and he took me to the registrar's office, and he said to them, "This is Eula DeWitt. Please take good care of her." And I started going to school. And they said, "What are you interested in studying?" I said, "Accounting." They said, "Oh, we don't have an accounting program at York College." So I had to study economics, which indirectly, that was a blessing because I would have never have volunteered to take calculus or statistics and probabilities. But because of the economics program that had some accounting classes, I started out with a major in economics. And before I graduated in 81, they did get a program of accounting. So I got a double major, a bachelor's of science, a double major in accounting and economics. And while I was there, because of college work study, I got a job working with the security force at the university. And when I applied for a job with the Internal Revenue Service as a field examiner, I got the job. So I started out working for the Internal Revenue Service as a field agent, grade 7, and that started me on my way. But I knew that I didn't know all that I needed to know. I don't think that we should ever stop learning. So what I did is start looking for an association where I could still study and have also some fellowship with other people of like minds or people that had attained an accomplishment in the field of accounting. And I joined the National Association of Accountants, and they met at the Penta Hotel. And to my amazement, I was so impressed with the meetings. There were people there that were the Port Authority CEO, Barry Weintraub, Charlie Gill, he was a partner in KPMG, Pete Marwick, and there was a gentleman who was a partner at Price Waterhouse. And Andrew Skevich, he was an executive at Avon. There were a lot of very significant, important people that really, Bob Strickler, he was Price Waterhouse partner. And I was impressed with these intelligent people, and I wanted to follow them around and be helpful. So that's how I got my start.
So you mentioned breaking in, so to speak, as a field agent for the IRS. What kind of work did that entail?
Well, you had to study the tax code, and you had to set up files and send out letters unfortunately, to people to let them know that the IRS wanted to take a look at their tax return and examine it. So I was a field agent, and they may have been a Schedule C filer, or they could have had some unfortunate situations where they were actually claiming that they had a loss, a net operating loss, and they carried it back over previous years. So they were actually, they had paid taxes, and then they would go back and take it all out. So the government, unfortunately, had to do something to help correct the misunderstanding of the rules and rules of engagement, you know, in terms of how you prepare your tax and how you operate your business. And it was very interesting. I mean, I started out not knowing nothing, but I found it very interesting and challenging to study and to study the codes and to be a part of different programs. And they had something that they called the tax shelter program, and I participated in that and had to write up cases. And I think that, you know, I have a lot of respect for everybody, no matter who you are. I try to give honor to you because, thank God, they try to work and try to file. But if something was not correct, you had to correct it. And that's another training that I was privileged to receive and to interact with people that were also entrepreneurs.
Did you feel like you were prepared when you had to give bad news to people as part of the job?
Well, I think that my point is that everyone has the right to pursue life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. And sometimes some of us are like children. We just want to get over. That's all we care about is getting over. Sometimes we might make a wrong path in order to get over in desperation. So I believe that when people show up to a workplace or participate in anything that's trying to make an attempt to survive, survival of the fittest, I think that's a wonderful thing. So I don't hold anybody in a place of they're perfect. I think we're always learning and growing. So I count it a privilege that they used me as an agent. But I'm an agent when I was an agent in the tax examination inside of Treasury as a privilege, but it's an obligation to do that which is pleasing to the rules of conduct and so forth, things like that. You know, mm-hmm. So we all make mistakes, and we have to correct our mistakes. And that's all that I represented, an agent for us to keep America strong.
And sort of on the flip side of that, what do you think is the most rewarding or the most satisfying aspect of either being an accountant or specifically working for the IRS?
Well, I have to be very frank and honest. I was privileged to have a badge, you know, and to say I'm a federal agent. I thought that was such a privilege because I don't think that that's a long thing that's been there forever. As a woman of color, mm-hmm. I think that I penetrated something becoming a federal agent. You can probably give a history of that. I didn't research that, so I can't really say, but I felt proud to have attained it. And when I was at the university, I didn't know the importance of being selected as who's who in colleges and universities, but I think it was a significant accomplishment. And I was born in South Carolina, and I was the youngest of my mother's 9 children, so she carried me around. And I never forgot when she told my father, who was working in New York, and we were in South Carolina, that's where we lived, and she said to him, "Get us out of here. They're hanging us." So I heard that, a 2-year-old child, I'll never forget what happened. So I understood that there were problems in the society. So I think that was in the recesses of my understanding, and so I learned how to be very careful and be very prayerful.
Mm-hmm. Do you find yourself doing any mentoring?
Oh, I love teaching. That's one of the things that I love to do, is share and teach. So therefore, I got to stay in school to study, because I can't accept the fact that even though I have attained a PhD, that I know everything, I have to keep learning over and over and over again. And one of my desires is to have opportunity to teach leadership training. But I don't think that it's just a class that you take, like you take a college course like calculus and now you have it down. No. Mm-hmm. Leaders need to stay in continuing evaluation of how far they've gone and examine what they've done and how they can improve. So I think that I hope that they don't hate me for saying this, but I think leaders have to continually be receiving CPEs too, so that they can, you know, look at themselves and project where they want to yet go forward in, and if they made some errors, to correct it, things like that.
Right. Leadership starts from the top. So you see yourself somewhat as a trailblazer for women of color, as you mentioned. What do you do to set yourself as that example? In what ways do you make yourself the sort of paradigm to follow?
Well, I don't necessarily understand it like you would. As a viewer of me, I just operate as a woman who honors the dispatcher, which is God, and I consider that there's a purpose for each of us, why we were dispatched at the time and place that we were, and to stay connected to the dispatcher and to get, like, your body, soul, and your spirit, right?
Mm-hmm.
Your body, you have to feed it, correct?
Right.
If you want it to grow, so you grow from a baby to an adult, but you had to feed it, and you have to nourish your body.
Mm-hmm.
I believe your soul is ancient, and so sometimes there are things in you that you have to heed, whether you like it or not. Now, I didn't interview you. I don't know your background and things of that nature, but if I did and I talk with you, then I could comprehend and understand the issues that might be a part of your method of living, the hurts that you may have encountered. That's in your spirit. So if you have a damaged spirit, that spirit needs to also be something that you recognize that you are a spirit, body, soul, and spirit, but you also have to grow in the spiritual understanding of the spiritual life. So for me, I chose to be a Christian. People can be worshiping things that are not of God, the dispatcher, which I got my PhD in King of the Cosmos. I wrote a book about who is the King of Kings. King of the Cosmos, I believe, is Jesus Christ. And so that gives me a background of a foundation based on studying his work and his life. And I respect everybody, but I have special honor to God, who is the dispatcher. So I honor him, and in all my ways I try to acknowledge him. And I try to get an understanding. So I didn't just accept Jesus Christ once. I accept him every day, the Spirit of God, to enter my chamber. I say, come into my chamber, feel free, Holy Spirit, and speak to me gently as I close my heart's door. Heavenly lover, may thy precious cover, Shekinah unended, is all I pray for. So who's in your spirit? Is it the gambling spirit? What's in your spirit? You know, who did you invite into your spirit today? Is it like with a buffet? Are you going to go there and get fat because you could eat all you want? And not all these different spirits, a greedy spirit, a selfish spirit, a jealous spirit. That's why I like to study, and I know I don't know everything, so I have to still grow and understand. And I can't understand everybody's pain, so how could I ever just know everything and I've arrived? You have to study.
Mm-hmm. So I'd like to talk a little bit more about your PhD. What was your area of study for that?
My PhD was in philosophy.
Okay. And where did you earn it?
I went to an institution that was really like a seminary.
Mm-hmm.
It's called Community Bible Institute. And it was a place where when I went there, I was very impressed with what I heard and saw. And I felt that the instructors at that time, which goes back quite a ways, I felt that they were really people that cared about the society and how we operated. So I was impressed with the setting.
Did the program require a thesis?
Oh, yes. I had to write a thesis. And I also, I chose, my first book that I wrote was on Isaiah, the prophet in the Bible.
Mm-hmm.
And I really feel that that was something that had touched my life. In the year that King Uzziah died, Isaiah said, I saw the Lord high and lifted up, and his train filled the temple. And the angels cried, holy, 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 the whole earth is full of thy glory. So things of that nature was in my spirit, and it caused me to want to have a deeper understanding of the deep things of the dispatcher, which is God.
So I feel like you've sort of touched on this a little bit, but I'd like to ask explicitly, how do you think your faith ties into your career?
I think that my greatest gift is my love for mankind.
Mm-hmm.
And I know we're not perfect, because when I was a little child, I said to you that my mother told my dad, get us out of here, they're hanging us.
Mm-hmm.
And when we left New York, my father sent a pickup truck to get us and bring us to New York. And he was working, and he had a friend in Harlem. And she took us in. We were like refugees in America.
Mm-hmm.
And 125th Street, her name was Miss Mary Robert Lewis Stevenson. I'll never forget because of her kindness. But when she was discovered that she had taken in this family, she got evicted. And we ended up in a shelter. I thought it was a shelter in Harlem, but a cousin who's older than me told me, no, that was a shelter in Chinatown. And it was only for women and children. The men could only visit. And I didn't understand about the hatred, but I knew it existed because of people being hung because of the color of their skin. That was horrible. So New York was more liberal at that time. And there was factories, you can get a job and earn a living. So my father had came here to support his family back in South Carolina. And the location of Chinatown was someplace I wouldn't know as a two-year-old child. But what happened is that I loved my dad. He was very much appreciative of having a family. And he used to come visit us. And one day he had visited, and I loved him so much, I followed him out of the shelter, but he didn't know it. I was only 2 years old, and I was a little girl lost in Chinatown. And thank God the police found me. And because of being the ninth child, and in my culture, the baby is protected by the siblings, but they were also jealous because I was the baby and I got a lot of attention. So they beat me up, and I learned how to talk because I had to say, help, save me. So I was a very articulate little girl at two, and that fascinated the police because they could ask me questions and I could answer it at 2 years old. And they were able to reunite me with my family.
Mm-hmm.
And my father asked my mother, he said he didn't have much money, you know, we were not well off. He said, I can give you a good Christmas or an apartment. And my mother said, give me the apartment. And the apartment was in Park Slope, Brooklyn. And it was a very good location for a child to be raised because it was a migrant area. It was 16th Street between 3rd and 4th Avenue and Park Slope. And my friends became like a global community. I'll never forget Aphrodite Spirokostas. I think she was Greek. Marion Gibbons, she was Irish. Patricia Monforti, she was Italian. So I had all types of people in my area of play, and it was a wonderful opportunity.
So I'd just like to ask, what do you think the future holds for you?
Well, you know, that's a good question. What does the future hold for me? I question what I'm yet supposed to do, but one of the things I feel I would love to do is to help us as a people, humankind, know to love each other. And I was hoping that I could get a radio program up and running, which I don't have the wherewithal I would need. I'd need some help. But I was hoping to get a radio program in place. That's one of my dreams. And it would be me talking for, you know, 10, 15 minutes on the air. And I was going to be called Prayerful and Careful, because I think that in our lifetime, we need to be prayerful. We need to pray even when we walk and talk. Just pray about everything and take it to the Lord. In other words, we all need counseling from the dispatcher. There's so many hurtful things that happen to families in this society because we're not counseled before we get involved with a relationship. And then after we get involved, we get married or whatever, we need counseling in order to maintain a happy situation for our families and the children. And there's so much education that's been out there, but sad to say, some of us want to benefit from someone else's pain and suffering. So I would like to help us as we go along life's way. I think I have a gift for teaching, so I'd love to teach, and I try to encourage people. I don't think that the knowledge that I've gained is for me. It's to pass it on and to love everybody and pass it on, that type of thing.
If I could make a recommendation, instead of a radio program, you might be better served producing a podcast.
Well, you see, you understand about a podcast, and I have to get educated in the understanding of what a podcast is all about. In other words, I don't care who we think we are, PhD or whatever, this life is full of swift transitions. So the younger people can help us in certain ways, and we can help them in certain ways. Sharing is caring. Caring and sharing and growing together in love, you know, loving each other. Do unto others as you'd have them do unto you. But know that somebody carried you when you couldn't walk. And now it may be your turn to carry somebody. And then maybe, who knows, maybe one day you won't be able to walk. Who knows what's going to happen before you retire out of the earth.
When you look back on your life as a whole and your career as a whole, what do you think is the most important lesson that you've learned?
I think the greatest lessons that I learned was at my mother's in her arms, and she would not let us, her children, leave the house without prayer. That was the greatest lesson. So she taught us to thank God for the food. Don't take that for granted, and we had to bless the food that we were about to receive. Let it be nourishment for our bodies. But she taught us to let the Word of God be the nourishment for our soul. That was my really great life lesson. And then she taught us how to pray, and she taught her children the Our Father's prayers. And she had 10 kids, my mother. I didn't know that my mother was, unfortunately, she lost her mother when she was 16, and her mother had 12 kids, and she had to help raise her siblings. And she didn't meet my dad till she was 23, and he was 30, and he told her he couldn't have kids, but they had 10. So my greatest lesson was that little is much when you place it in the master's hand. So she had little, but she had a lot of love for everyone. And I understand from other people who knew her, like, you know, because you're a baby, you don't necessarily know your mother and her struggles when you're just a baby.
Right.
But she showed us how to love, because she did it. In other words, she didn't just say it. She acted it out. So that was a life lesson of, you know, why I feel what I'd like to be depositing is loving and caring and sharing and depositing, you know, added strength to a situation. But you have to examine it. In other words, if you want to mentor somebody, they're going to have to be able to trust you. Some of us, we don't trust anybody because we've been so hurt. So all of those issues are still resonating in my understanding. So I still have a lot to yet learn and do. So I'll always be a student as well as a teacher.
So Eula, at this point, I'd ask if there's anything you'd like us to cover that we haven't had a chance to mention yet.
Well, I would say that this morning, unfortunately, I heard of a young white male who, I don't know how long ago he did this, but it was on the news, and he was going hunting for some black men to kill them. I don't know if it was black women and black men, but I think that, sad to say, we need to come together as humans, because I don't think any other animal in the kingdom of God treats their other, I don't know, maybe I'm ignorant about, you know, the animals, but they usually don't distinguish themselves because of the color of this, of their outward appearance. It's matters of the heart. So I would hope that we could understand as humans, with all our technological advancement, that we're all humans, and we need to appreciate all the different values that each of us bring to the table. And we don't have to all agree, but we should sit down and talk and learn to disagree in an agreeable manner so we don't have to constantly study how to kill each other and eliminate each other. I think that that's a real big issue. And then I believe that we'd have heaven on earth. You know what I'm saying?
Mm-hmm.
If we learned how to love and care and share and appreciate the gift of knowing that we're human, but we don't all see the same. I just want to say one of the things that I'd like to give honor to is a person who just passed away. His name is Reverend Dr. Stanley Kemp. And he put a ring on my finger, an engagement ring.
Mm-hmm.
And sad to say, he passed away before he, he may have performed a marriage vow to me as he was dying because he put a ring on my finger. And he was a reverend. And he graduated from Yale with his Master's of Divinity in 1948. But there are a lot of people of that type. No, I don't mean a lot, but there are many people that they knew who they were, but they never got proper recognition for the contribution that they made to the betterment of our society.
Mm-hmm.
And I'd just like to give honor to him because he gave lectures and classes in Christian education for 70 years. And to me, that is awesome. Just determined. It wasn't about money. It was about determination to deposit seed into people's lives so that they could reap a harvest of love. Needs to walk together, pray together, encourage each other to grow together. But I believe that you have need of a biological family and also a spiritual family. So let's say you don't have any children, but you can have a church family. You need to have a family, a body, soul, and spirit. You need a church. You know, your body is biological, so you may have blood relations, but you also need people that are part of your family in your community and people that are part of your family in where you worship and give honor to whom honor is due, like the parents, the mothers, the fathers, and the leaders in the community. So there's so much correction that we need to do because our society, to me, has been broken. So, yes, my children are existing, but they have a lot of different issues that they may not be able to talk about, just like perhaps you as a man. I can't imagine the pain that a man suffers because we are very competitive as a nation and a global society. So there's a lot of things that I feel I need to address and help correct. But I'm grateful that I have children and I have grandchildren. And I even have great-grandchildren. I feel so privileged that God would allow me to participate in having offsprings. So David, Andre, John, Andre Jr., Aramis, Anthony, Ariel, you know, this a lot of people, you know, I'm talking about my bloodline and my grandchildren and my great-grandchildren. I just thank God. But these are people that are going to grow up to be men or women, and they are going to have to overcome hurdles and bumps in the road, and that's why family is important, that we love each other, and no matter what, it's unconditional love.
I'm sure you make them very proud and vice versa.
Well, I hope. I try my best. We don't know how we affect people, but we try our best to do the best we can.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, Eula, for taking the time out of your day to share your story with our listeners. I want to thank everyone for tuning in to Marquee Radio. Stay tuned for more in-depth and informative interviews with professionals from all walks of life.